presentation in Parliament, and I come from the centre-left, which is the party basically backing the current government. It's my second time as chairman of the Foreign and European Affairs Committee. I'm very glad that in this committee, both parties, even my colleague, Dr. Mario De Marco, who comes from the opposition party, we collaborate a lot, and we have very much the same ideas and vision for our foreign policy. So this committee is very fruitful in the sense that we try to even help government in its foreign policy and in its direction. I'm a former minister, as my colleague as well, Honourable De Marco, and we attach great importance to this committee because I believe that the parliamentary dimension in our foreign affairs, especially when in a situation where it's a two-party, so it's a bit a polarized system, we come out, obviously, as one with one voice with regards to our foreign policy. As a small country, relatively Denmark, obviously, but it is in the grand scheme of things a small country as well. I believe that it's very important for us to look outwards and to try to be involved as much as possible, and I believe that historically we managed always to punch above our weight, in the sense that as a small country we maintained our relevance, both on Mediterranean, European, as now as a member for the last 21 years of the European Union, and obviously internationally, as you rightly said, as well with our membership at the Security Council of the United Nations. So, as you said, these are basically the main fora, as the OSCE as well, which I believe with the help of countries like Denmark as well, we can increase the relevance of such an entity, such an organization. And so, in that regard, and then we will continue, so I give the word to my colleague as well. On these lines and these parameters, I believe both countries can do a lot of good at government level, but also vis-à-vis the parliamentary dimension, which I give it a lot of weight. Please, Honourable De Marco.
Thanks so much, and apologies for being late, first of all. So I come from the Nationalist Party. The name of the party may be a bit of a misnomer today, for the simple reason that the name Nationalist Party came about prior to independence, because it was a party which was seeking independence from the British then empire, which ruled Malta. It's a party which owns its origins, the Christian Democratic Party, so Christian Democratic origins. So I would say that we too come from the centre-left, because if one looks at the origins of the Christian Democratic Party, it's a party which is a centre party, but we always say that if you had to look towards the right or towards the left, we'd probably look towards the left rather than towards the right. Having said that, we do form part of the PPE, the European Popular Parties, within the European Union, which is perhaps more traditionally oriented towards a centre-right politics, but I think today the issues of centre-right or centre-left seem to have lost the compass. But anyway, I think everybody is very much on the centre part of politics today. In terms of foreign policy, because ultimately we are a member of the Foreign European Affairs Committee, I think that today there's a lot of convergence on the issue of, I would say, foreign policy. I pride in the fact that my party, when it was in government, was a party which drove for European Union membership. Initially, that was resisted by the Liberal Party of my dear colleague and friend. but there was a referendum, and when the Maltese population decided to vote in favour of Malta acceding to the European Union, and to be fair, the country has not looked back. So there is no temptation of any form of Megxit from the Maltese side. I think the general population is very much very happy with EU membership. A team which has also found constant conversion is the fact that we strongly believe that we hold, or we should strive to hold, a role within the European Union for a Mediterranean policy within the European Union. So we have always firmly believed that the old adage within what was then the CSCE and today is the OSCE of no peace in the Mediterranean without peace in Europe, and no peace in Europe without peace in the Mediterranean. And I think we have always tried to emphasize our belief that Europe must not only look within the continent, but also should look further out of the continent, also towards what is happening within the Mediterranean basin and the countries which obviously line the southern part of the Mediterranean basin. Obviously, what's happening in Gaza and in the West Bank, and also obviously in Israel with the tragedy of the 7th October, is of great concern to all of us. Whilst we have obviously unreservedly condemned what happened on the 7th October of last year, we are also greatly concerned with the loss of innocent lives in Gaza and regrettably also in the West Bank. So we obviously look forward to a solution which ultimately we firmly believe the ultimate solution should be with the release of the hostages, with a cessation of hostilities within Gaza, but ultimately also towards a two-state solution, because that is the only real solution which can ultimately really bring peace, we believe, within the Middle East. We're obviously greatly concerned also with the escalation of things which are happening within the Middle East, particularly where Iran is concerned. Obviously, we need to see and read the way things are developing within the United States and the developments of the political scenario over there. And obviously, we cannot forget what's happening also in Ukraine. So, again, even though Malta is a neutral country, we have pledged our full support for Ukraine. Being a neutral country doesn't mean that you have to be neutral in the face of hostilities, in the face of aggression, in the face of a totally unjustified and unprovoked occupation of an innocent country, which is Ukraine. So we have our full support for the Ukrainian people. We also fully understand the developments that have taken place in Denmark, also with NATO. And from our end, insofar as concerns as well NATO, we have taken an approach of having a tailor-made, program. So from that end as well, we are, obviously, even though we're not members of NATO, but we, I would say, there's a large degree of participation and collaboration. So we obviously look on towards the way the political scenario internationally is developing. It's of great concern because the way things are developing is of concern, I believe, to everybody. And we look forward to any formal way that we can promote international dialogue. So I think at this stage in time, I would say rest my case, because I'm a lawyer by profession, but I look forward to hearing your perspective of things, obviously. Thank you.
If we start from Ukraine, of course, we were very happy to read your statement or your line in the statement on concerning the chairmanship of the OSCE. Because it was a very strong support for the right of self-determination and the right of independence of Ukraine. And, of course, for small countries, rule of laws is very decisive. I mean, if we have a situation where big countries can conquer small countries, I mean, everything will stop. So that's very good. We also understand, of course, what you're saying about neutrality. But as you also said, you cannot be neutral between right and wrong. And the invasion and the Russian attack on Ukraine in order to try to conquer Ukraine, I mean, can from all standards be described as wrong. In Denmark, from the left to the right, we have said that we supported Ukraine and giving all kind of material support, including support for self-defense. We know you don't have F-16s fighter here. We have. They were quite old, but we gave them, and we also have given other weapons in order that Ukraine can defend themselves. And we give now money for that Ukraine can develop weapon fabrication, weapon industry, primary ammunition themselves. And there perhaps one question, what are the reason why you are making this distinction between humanitarian help and help that they can defend themselves? Because, I mean, if they don't get arms, if they don't get the capacity to arm themselves, I mean, it will be over. And we already see the risk for that Russian can, you know, take much more land, because even what has been given had not been enough. So why are you making this distinction without discussing the neutrality? Because even as a neutral, you could support other ways than just humanitarian.
You permit, as my colleague said, this issue of neutrality is very not only dear to us in the sense that it's something which has been enshrined in our constitution, agreed by both parties. From time to time, there is a discussion where the definition we have in the constitution is maybe should be amended or should cater for today's times. But obviously we make that distinction because I appreciate what you said, because that is the situation on the ground, in the sense that if they don't have a military capacity to defend themselves, I mean, but obviously it is worded in that manner, our position, because to reach consensus even at a national level, we have to be quite cautious in our approach. But as my colleague said, we were quite categorically, although our military capability is, as you said, we were quite categorical in supporting Ukraine and in denouncing what is an act of aggression by Russia, which had happened before in the area of Crimea, and obviously history repeats itself. So we are full square behind Ukraine. President Zelensky has even addressed our parliament as well. So both parties in parliament were very attentive and were very keen to listen. And I can say that at this stage, and not only at this stage, from the beginning, we are full square, and we will be full square with Ukraine. But maybe this particular distinction is obviously to our political situation, which as you said, neutrality has to be adapted from time to time, because it is a concept. Shall we be actively neutral, passively neutral? So this is a debate. It's a constitutional debate, but it's also a practical debate, because we have to react to situations like Russia's aggression to Ukraine, which we have to respond. I mean, it's not only a theoretical thing now, but we have to direct our foreign policy and shape our foreign policy to cater for such circumstances. Another issue, which I believe it's tied to security as well, is the question of EU enlargement, which we didn't touch. And a lot of aspiring countries, including, as an example, Albania, obviously they are posing, they are putting forward another argument now, that it's not only a rule of law issue, that they have to do reforms in accordance to the Copenhagen criteria, but Obviously, now it is more imminent in the sense that it is a more of a security issue as well. So this is something which both Denmark and Malta have to face within the European Union fora, our standpoint with regards to a process of enlargement. I know that the European institutions are saying that there is a process, but obviously these countries will have to be, in my opinion, very attentive in the sense that if we don't structure an enlargement process with a certain momentum, obviously there is a danger always that some countries will look elsewhere, which is not obviously desirable for us and for the European Union. So this issue, I believe, that enlargement should take a top priority even at an EU level. And another point which I believe the Hungarian presidency is pushing forward, and I believe that it's not a question that the Hungarian presidency is pushing forward, but it is important, is a new competitive, economic and competitive policy for the European Union. I believe that both countries have an interest in having a competitive Europe which can match other big markets and giants like China, Asia. So that is something which I think, I believe, okay, between us we don't have a lot of commercial exchanges. We have some commercial exchanges, but there is a lot more which we can do between us. But even at a European level, we have an interest that obviously we see a more competitive Europe which can match these big powers, economic powers at a global level. Thank you very much.
But concerning enlargement of the EU, I mean, what you're saying is totally correct. And we have the situation in Macedonia. We have the problem with Serbia. We have Albania, I mean, Bosnia, Georgia, very, very clearly. The official Danish position have been that enlargement should be based on merits. So there are certain standards. You have to live up to these standards. If you don't live up to these standards, then you have to do more homework. And of course, the reason for that is that we have, for example, we have seen with Hungary, what happened in Hungary, which gives a lot of problems. And if we allow countries to come in, which is not ready, it could give problems politically, like Hungary, but it could also give a lot of problems with, you know, what we in Denmark call social dumping, workers traveling around with very low wages and things like that. And when you're mentioning Albania, the real problem, seen from my perspective, is that Albania also need to change a little bit its political culture. I mean, we have had meetings with Albania where they said, we are ready, we have done everything, you know, and both parties was there. And then you turn on your television and then you see people fighting in the parliament and throwing chairs out and burn them from the parliament in the streets. So, and imagine that it was an EU country. So therefore, I mean, our problem, we have some real problem, and it's not simple to find a solution. Have you considered what could be done in order to attract and keep countries very close to the perspective and at the same time not watering away what is inside the European Union?
If I may. Obviously, membership is always, to a large degree, a bit of a gamble. If we look at, however, historically, and I'm not here to give any lectures to anybody, I'm the last person to lecture on this, but what membership to the then European community had done to countries like Greece and Spain, which had come out of military juntas to a large degree and joined the European community then. I mean, today we look back and nobody doubts the credentials of Greece and Spain. Possibly then it was a gamble, but it was a gamble that worked, because thanks to the membership of Greece and Spain within the then European Community, or the EEC, the concept of membership and dialogue made sure that the military past of Greece and Spain at that, possibly more Spain than Greece, and Portugal as well, it ensured that they became fully fledged democracies. So that is where membership anchored their democracy, really. If they did not become members of the European Community, we don't know what part either of these countries may have taken, realistically. Now, in the case of Hungary, yes, of course, there are concerns and very large concerns with the way the government is tackling. But much better to have a problem within and try and address it also within that table of the European Commission than have those problems addressed from outside of the table and outside the room of the EU. I think the EU has much larger a chance of successfully transforming Hungary for the better than if one had to simply exclude Hungary and to a large degree punish those people within Hungary who do believe in a democratic, forward-looking Hungary. And we've seen this thing happen to a certain degree with also other countries, when sometimes you leave an aspiring country, wait for too long a time, hoping that they will meet our criteria, it has a chance of making them turn away. Again, I don't want to be too controversial, but if you look at, to a certain degree, Turkey has always been a controversial issue as to whether Turkey should be a member of the European Union or not. And realistically, also, there are many people who doubted not only Turkey's democratic credentials, but also Turkey's European credentials. Okay, so, I mean, Turkey is to a large degree a Eurasian country. Is it more Asian than European, or is it more European than Asian? But again, the reality is that dialogue from outside is always much harder, I feel, than dialogue from within. And despite the risk that you're right, that when we tell a country, do your homework, we risk that people get tired of waiting. And they look forward a lot to the European Union for aspirations to raise their standards. But if they feel that we're making them wait too long, they may get the feeling that Europe doesn't want them. And that is the worst message, I think, that we can ever give to a country where a people, as opposed to the country, have suffered a lot and have a lot of hope in us. They do have a lot of... Many people on the ground, whether it's in Serbia, whether it's in Albania, whether it's in Georgia, whether it's in Ukraine, they look forward to the European Union as a beacon of hope. And if we keep putting that beacon further away, people who lose hope go astray. First of all, I fully agree with you, and the examples you gave of Latvia and Estonia are perfect cases. I mean, today, as you rightly pointed out, had we made Estonia and Latvia wait, they could have very easily gone back to the Russian sphere of influence. Insofar as concerns Israel and the Palestinian cause, obviously, I mean, whilst we have very good relationship with Israel as a country, and yes, we fully respect the right of the Israeli people, we fully believe in the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination and to statehood. So we have always believed in a two-state solution, and that is the only lasting solution. Now, a two-state solution obviously requires effort from both sides. I think both sides have erred in different ways. But again, if you give people no hope, they turn to despair. So if the police, I mean, despite all the various accords and which have always tried to bring a two-state solution, if we look at the West Bank today, are we anywhere close towards a Palestinian-led authority within the West Bank? We're not. You have settlements which take place all the time, increasing, and now you have a move within the Israeli parliament as we speak to annex the settlements within the West Bank to form part of Israel. So these things don't help. And I think if the European Union, which is probably one of the largest unions which try to help the Palestinian people, I think needs to have a much more powerful and stronger foreign policy and voice. Unfortunately, Europe's voice on foreign policy is very often too weak and too silent. And in something like this, where you have so many innocent lives on both sides of the camp, because many Israelis have lost their life innocently, but so have so many Palestinians lost their life innocently. I mean, as many people say, and rightly say, not every Palestinian is a Hamas terrorist, not every Palestinian is a... But nearly every Palestinian has lost hope. And so I think if we really want to look towards a far-reaching peace in the Middle East, yes, for many more these people, and for both sides of the political spectrum in Malta, whilst we fully respect the Israeli people and the strength that they always have shown against all the hardness that history has shown them, we equally have to be sensitive to what the Palestinians are going through. And they equally deserve statehood, in my honest opinion.
Just coming back to the question of enlargement of the European Union, have you had any discussions if there should be a broader enlargement soon, what it will demand from the EU in terms of rules and regulation inside the EU? Because one of the problems, for example, the budget, the financial framework has to be agreed unanimously. And we have seen, for example, Hungary using these moments to put pressure on the whole system. And the risk, of course, is that this will be worse. So have you had a discussion? What kind of changes do we need to make inside the European Union in order perhaps to enlarge? Then I know that in Brussels, and absolutely not something discussed in Denmark, but at least not official, but in Brussels there's also some ideas that you could take in countries, but then you could take them in stages. So, for example, the question of the full voting right or the veto right will come at a later moment. Have you discussed things like that?
Obviously, in a formal manner, I would say no. But obviously, what you're saying, it's a very important discussion at a new level, not only for budgetary purposes. Another issue is, if there is an enlargement, how will the institutions like the Council work with more countries and with a lot of issues, a lot of competences requiring unanimity? Obviously, I'm speaking for myself, but I'm very confident that my colleague will share the same view, with the question, obviously, of the extension of qualified majority voting. Obviously, it will be, to a certain extent, to the detriment of small countries within the EU. Now, that will bring a discussion, a healthy discussion, which areas, for example, taxation, which is something which obviously is of interest to Malta because of certain niches, professional economic niches, which we have in Malta, which are very important for us. So formally no, but obviously what you rightly say is a discussion which has to happen. Even this question of enlargement, there has to be something more structured and with a certain momentum. Not that countries accede to the European Union without merit, because obviously they have to meet the Copenhagen criteria. I believe that is the minimum for integration, because obviously, as you said, the countries have to share the same values. Let's start from there. But I believe that without a structured system of going somewhere vis-à-vis enlargement, I'm not saying that it happens tomorrow, but having a direction, obviously, it's countries will have a temptation, will have pressures, will have domestic pressures, elections, that they will start looking elsewhere. And in the situation, in this particular situation, this is more dangerous in the sense that we're living in a situation where we have a war in Europe. We have a migration problem in Europe. Obviously, we see our Mediterranean component of migration, but migration is not a problem of the Mediterranean, it's a problem of Europe. So we have to share the situation and shoulder the situation together. I believe that this should be discussed more parliamentary dimension, government dimension. At the moment, I feel that we are a bit at a standstill, obviously, due to the reasons that there were big challenges ahead, which we had the pandemic, we had the Russian aggression of Ukraine. Obviously, there is the situation in the Middle East. It's not a European problem, but it affects Europe as well. As regards what my colleague said with regards to our policy vis-à-vis Palestine, I believe that I can say and be proud to say that we were one of the most consistent countries in the sense of foreign policy, with the help of Professor Guido De Marco, which happens to be the father of my colleague, which had a huge impact with regards to this two-state solution, which we firmly believe that is the only, I believe it's the only solution to the region. Self-determination and obviously respect, equality between the peoples, and respect and statehood. We believe that. And even our former president as well, Honorable George Vella, who was foreign minister as well before, we were very consistent in saying that this is a solution. But obviously it is another European challenge that we don't speak with one voice vis-à-vis our foreign policy. That is something which we have to, it's not only that we have a high representative, okay, but when we reply, in my opinion, we reply a bit late as well. Our responsiveness with regards to our positions due to the structures, due to the decision-making process, we reply a bit, we react a bit late. So these are the challenges of the European Union. But as my colleague said, we are very proud members of the European Union. We had our differences, as he rightly and timely underlined. and pulling a bit my leg in the process, but it's okay. But today we're convinced that the European Union has been had a very good impact on Malta, on our economy, on the way we think, as the social dimension as well, which obviously it's rule of law reforms, which we did along the line, and I believe it's a very important experiment, but as you rightly said, with its challenges and big challenges ahead. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much for all this stuff from now. We've been touched a little bit about migration, and I want to ask you, because my Prime Minister, our Prime Minister, has on several occasions suggested that asylum should be preceded outside the borders of Europe. So should be before you enter this dangerous journey across the Mediterranean. And I heard your, and that was a bit new to me, I don't know if I'm lost for fantasy, your parliamentary speaker this morning, follow the money, all this trade with the people, or the crime that organizes people to take these dangerous journeys. They earn some money. Where does these money end up? Half, we learned yesterday, at the, I think it was EUAA, at the asylum agency, is that only half of asylum seekers actually have a protection need. So what would you think about a solution which to me would be more humane with the deal done before entering the dangerous tour? What's your perspective?
What can I say? Obviously, first of all, we're very proud that we have a big presence, an agency which is the prior it was EASO, but now it's EUAA. Formerly known as EASO, which has a big presence in Malta. I believe it's one of the Malta, it's second only if I remember, to Greece, because there is a bigger presence of the agency in Greece. So we're proud of that, obviously. As you said, there are economic migrants as well. Ideally, your position, it's ideal, but obviously, from a practical sake, we have to see the problems of how you do it. But it is that's the root of the problem. How to tackle it? It's not easy to say. But obviously, we have to tackle the problem. It's a problem which the Maltese people are concerned about. It's a sentiment which both parties, being center parties, as honourable DeMarco said, we don't give vent to obviously dangerous talk about foreigners, because foreigners have a role and should be respected in our country. That's a European value which we have to treasure. We follow the rules of the EU. We follow the judgments, because even the European Court of Justice has been quite consistent and as well molded to say the position of countries and any abuse in not treating these people, which are human beings like us, with their basic rights. We have to grant that basic right. But the problem has to be addressed together. It's not an easy problem. It's not a problem, as I said, of the Mediterranean. Other countries have their pressures as well. But the worst thing, in my opinion, to do is that Member States take unilateral means to tackle the problem. I believe that it should be dealt with, obviously, with the contribution of the Member States and the governments of the Member States. But I believe that there should be an EU solution or an EU address to the problem. Not unilaterally, because unilaterally a country will try to face the problem, but maybe there will be a spillover on another member state with that decision. So I don't believe that it should be taken unilaterally by a member state, but the EU should, it is giving importance, but should give more importance to this problem, because it is a concern a big concern, it's becoming a big concern of community, of community citizens.
I think I just may simply add to what Honourable Zamek Lewis has said. Obviously, the risk with allowing countries to take unilateral measures as opposed to allowing the European Union to take serious measures is that you end up getting the Orbans of this world. So, hence why I think it's important that the EU has a proper policy to address this issue. I think Malta for many years and Italy have been at, and Greece have been at the receiving end for quite a few years of migration coming from the Mediterranean. And the reality is that whilst, yes, we have been at the receiving end, but we're at the receiving end of, as you indicate, waves of human tragedies, because for the people who actually make it to our shores, and that of Italy and that of Greece, so many people have lost their life. Not only lost their lives in the Mediterranean Sea, but may have lost their life crossing the desert from the Sub-Sahara, crossed their lives at the hands of people in Libya and other countries, I mean, and crossed their lives at the hands of these criminals who organize these trips, which very often are doomed to fail. So it's a human tragedy for the people who try to make these crossings. Obviously, at the same time, we cannot ignore the fact that, yes, you have people in countries like, especially Italy, especially like Greece, especially like Spain as well, who have been at the receiving end. However, having said that as well, it is a European problem, because many of these people, I'm going to be very frank, don't just simply cross to come to Malta, to stay in Malta. They come to Malta because they ultimately want to go up to the continent and try and, again, live the European dream. So at the end, and likewise, so we have to be realistic that they're coming and crossing, not necessarily to come to us, to come to Italy, to come to Greece, or to go to Spain, but many of them may have families who are living in Germany, in France, in Scandinavia. I mean, and this is the reality now. So we need to have a proper solution. Now, the proper solution is not always necessarily making an asylum across the border. Ideally, the ideal solution is that you solve the political problems from their countries, you solve the economic problems in Africa, but this won't happen overnight. It may not even happen in our lifetime. Okay, but so in reality, there's a problem which needs to be addressed and needs to be addressed collectively and in a human way.
I felt a certain frustration over the EU in when we are talking about Palestine, Israel, that EU is not doing what you think they should. And you're much nearer through the problem than we are. But of course, as you said, it affected the whole of Europe. What can be done? Because as it is now, I mean, people are slaughtered every day. And it just go on and go on and go on, and we see the frustration in our countries. We have big demonstrations in Denmark, we have big demonstrations in all over, and people are getting more and more angry. And when we meet with colleagues from out of Europe, they said, double standard, you have double standards, huh? So who will be able to take initiative? Would you, as a neutral country, or countries like you, be able to take some initiatives in order to create that momentum, which is necessary? You know, Biden put forward, or Kamala Harris put forward, that now they got 30 days and then something will happen, but this out, I mean, after the result of the election, this is just a way. So it's just going on. Have you any idea what can be done in order to start another program?
I mean, it's a million-dollar question, really. But realistically, it all depends on who's going to be an honest broker. I mean, if you look at Qatar, Qatar is not a superpower, but I think it's been trying to play a significant role in getting the parties together. Has it succeeded? It has not, so far. Okay, so ultimately a lot depends on the pressure being put on the Israeli government, the representatives of the Palestinian people, and ultimately America has an important role to play, undoubtedly. We need to know how that role is going to map out now after January. But again, going back to the point you rightly pointed out, Europe, if it wants, has a significantly important role to play, because it's close, I think. It's a country which is close to Israel, but it's equally close to the Palestinian people. It's one of the largest, I think, contributors of aid to the Palestinian people. But I think Europe needs to understand that not every problem is solved by throwing money at it. Whether it's migration, whether it's the problem with the Palestinian people, Gaza, West Bank, Israel, money doesn't always solve the problems. It may address certain problems. Problems are solved when there is the political will to solve them. And we cannot hide away from a lack of political will by simply throwing aid. Aid is only there to try and soften our conscience, but doesn't solve problems.
Thank you very much for all your answers. Perhaps the last question. We talked in the beginning about your membership of the Security Council. How did the Parliament work with this question? Was it only a question for the government, or was the Parliament involved in any way, and if it was, how?
First of all, it's a government thing in the sense that there is a representative of the government, obviously, of Malta, not of the government, of Malta. Our foreign minister and deputy prime minister keeps us informed. He is a member of this committee, and we were always informed about the situation, and obviously we discussed different issues which were our priorities for our term in the Security Council. That was the parliamentary interface. But I can say that we have a very frank relationship with the minister. Obviously, he's representing the government, and regular feedback about not only the Security Council, but also about other things which are of relevance to this committee. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the committee reserves the right as well, even all the members that we put on the agenda issues which we deem that are of importance to this committee, to Parliament, and after all to the people which we represent.
Thank you very much for taking your time. We're very happy that you gave us all your point of views. We have a very small token of appreciation. So, from the Danish Parliament, so.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. Have a nice evening. It's your last meeting now, so.
The minister, yes, tonight.
Today. Tomorrow, with the
Minister of Foreign Affairs.